This episode is brought to you by Bombas. Summer's here and we're all chasing something. Maybe it's a break, a goal, a vibe. Well, let's not let bad socks and blisters ruin it. I know in my household, we are not letting that happen because my wife and I love Bombas socks. In fact, it's pretty much all we wear right now because they are such a step up in quality from your usual socks. They are comfortable, they are soft, they are functional, they're not going to fall down during the day, so you have to keep pulling them up. And guess what? They look good too, so maybe you want to look stylish for a wedding. It's wedding season. Well, Bombas has great stuff that's going to make you the best dressed guest. And if you're a runner like Paul, well, Bombas running socks, they wick sweat, they help keep you cool and fight blisters, but they also make specialized pairs for tennis, golf, hiking, you name it. And of course, we all love Bombas Mission, where one pair purchased equals one donated to someone who needs it. Head over to bombas.com and use the code CURB for 20% off your first purchase. That's BOMBAS.com, code CURB at checkout. Bombas.com and use the code CURB.
The Curbsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity, aside from possibly Cash Like More Hospital and affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're wrong.
Paul, we're back. We've done it. This was an episode. This was an episode on ventilator management, a little bit on ARDS and COVID, and managing that. Our guest, Dr. Kevin Chung. Before Cyrus tells us a little bit more about that, Paul, can you remind people what is it that we do on this show?
I am happy to, now that I am fully comfortable managing ARDS and intubation. We are the Internal Medicine Podcast. We use expert interviews to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge. And Cyrus, tell us who we're talking to tonight.
I'd love to do that. This is really special for me because Dr. Chung was a mentor of mine as a resident. And so it's with great excitement that I think we bring to you Colonel Kevin Chung, MD, who is a proud active duty Army internist who happens to also be a medical intensivist. He is currently the chair of medicine at the Uniformed Services University in Bethesda, Maryland, and holds academic appointments as a professor in the Department of Medicine, as well as the Department of Surgery. Dr. Chung has cared for a variety of challenging critically ill patients over the years to include combat casualties, burns, multi-trauma, as well as bread-and-butter medical intensive care unit patients. He is a multi-organ failure enthusiast fascinated by various mechanic ventilator strategies, renal replacement therapy, ECMO, and other novel extracorporeal organ support technologies. Currently, he's on the front lines of this current pandemic, caring for critically ill COVID-19 patients at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center.
I was just going to say, Cyrus, I don't think anyone's ever called themselves a multi-organ enthusiast before. Multi-organ failure enthusiast.
That phrase has probably never been uttered.
Yeah.
Though I am something just of a general failure enthusiast, so I can kind of sympathize.
Okay. All right. So without further ado, let's get to this episode where we talk all about the patient that's going to be on mechanical ventilation and a bit about some of the principles of how to approach patients with COVID-19 and ARDS. Kevin, you've invited us down to USU in the past, and now we're inviting you into our virtual recording studio. We are so excited to have you here. Can you give the audience a one-liner about yourself?
Well, first, thank you so much for this tremendous opportunity. It's a big honor. So I'm a 47-year-old, one-and-a-half-generation Korean-American Army internist slash intensivist, husband and father of three well-adjusted teenagers, well, generally, and known in my old neighborhood for my chicken wings.
Okay. And you're talking about like... You're not talking about your arms because people would make fun of me for having chicken wing shoulder blades.
No, those are buffalo chicken wings fried.
Okay.
Right. And follow up question. Why are they notorious? Tell me about the chicken wings, please.
Well, you know, every time I made them, I generally, put a lot of work into it, a lot of TLC. I actually marinate it in lemon and beer and only Miller Lite seems to work. I do that for about 24 hours. And then I, drain it, obviously, and dust it with a little cornstarch. And I have it down where, every batch I make, it's 8 minutes, comes out nice and crispy. And the neighborhood kids just absolutely love it. And so anytime I, make the chicken wings, or I used to in my old neighborhood, they would all come over and then be gone in, 30 minutes.
That was just exactly the answer I wanted. And it's funny, I don't like Miller Lite at all. And yet for some reason, as a cooking beer, it is almost perfect. Like it's wings, it's spaghetti delicious. Sauce. It's ideal.
Yeah. It's delicious.
All right.
Sorry, Wanda. Do you want to talk about medicine or something? Or
No. I think we have time for one or two more questions. Cyrus, do you want to ask anything before we get on to the topic, which is a big topic?
I would love to. And it's, super exciting to have you here, Dr. Chung. Very, very glad to have made this work. I think since you're a lifelong learner and a lifelong educator, I'm curious as to what the best advice you've ever received as a learner has been, and then maybe as a teacher.
Right. So, I think instead of best advice, I'll tell you maybe the best, biggest lesson that I've ever took away. And some of you know that I spent a lot of time in the burn center early in my career after my critical care fellowship. And when I first got there, I met with the commander, which happened to be, his name is John Holcomb. He's pretty well known in the trauma community. Well, anyway, he sat me down and he said, hey, it was the Institute of Surgical Research. I was an internist in a very foreign land taking care of burn patients. And he sat me down and said, you know why we're here? And I, looked at him and I said, why? And he goes, we're here to change practice. And what I realized he meant by that is that as we took care of very severely burned patients, what I realized is that sometimes standard of care is not enough. And you got to do things. You got to, during the day-to-day practice, your clinical practice, you have to always be on the lookout for things that you can improve. I think that's something that I took away from that experience in the burn center, that early experience. And I'm always looking around for things that, aren't doing the job, standard of care is just not doing the job. And I'm always trying to figure out how to improve that process or that therapy, so on and so forth. And so, yes, I'm an educator and a lifelong learner. I'm also a part-time researcher. And so that's really the lens through which I practice medicine.
That's particularly pertinent advice for right now and for the topic that we're going to be talking about. I want to move into the topic. And before we do that, did you have a disclaimer that you wanted to make? We've had a couple shows with folks from the military, and there's always a disclaimer that goes along with it.
Right. I guess in my own words, anything I say during this podcast does not represent the official views of the DOD or the Army. They're my personal views.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. So with that, Cyrus the Younger, will you read a case from Cashlack Memorial?
Absolutely. So we have Mr. RDS, who's a 58-year-old male with a past medical history of diabetes and hypertension, who presents to the Cashlack ED with 3 days of fever, dry cough, malaise, and shortness of breath. He's in moderate respiratory distress on exam, with a chest x-ray showing diffuse bilateral opacities. Given strong concern for COVID-19, a PCR swab is obtained and pending. Despite receiving 15 liters of oxygen via non-rebreather mask, his oxygen saturation is 88%. The ED calls you for admission. So that's our case, and I think I'll start with the question, what are the two or three kind of questions you might have for the patient or the patient's family upon that initial encounter? And is there anything else specific that you would want to ask the emergency medicine provider at that time?
Well, thanks, Iris. Well, the presentation that you just described, in the context of this pandemic, he's already in trouble. And so my initial evaluation is going to be very focused and very rapid. And as I'm evaluating the patient, at the end of the day, you can't stop being a good internist. And so even though we're in the midst of this pandemic, a lot of different things can cause diffuse bilateral opacities on a chest x-ray. And so you got to really focus in on ruling out the most important things. Does a patient have CHF? Did he come in with a history of heart disease? And then really focus in on a really abbreviated physical exam. So I would listen for a murmur very quick using, a proper PPE, obviously, but a thesoscope that's disposable. As far as what I'm going to ask the ED physician, I already have the information that I need from that description alone. I know the patient's already in trouble. They have evolving disease that needs action pretty rapidly. Maybe in terms of laboratory values, I would probably start with an ABG with a lactate. I would probably ask for a BNP. I would probably, in that panel would include a ProCal. And then in order to rule out all the different other respiratory illnesses that are infectious, I would fire off a BioFire and get that panel cooking. And my biggest concern right now is getting this patient probably to the ICU as quickly as possible if he looks okay. If not, then I'm going to be thinking in the back of my mind, is this somebody that I need to prepare to intubate or ask the team to intubate in their emergency department?
I just wanted to clarify the panel that you mentioned, the BioFire, that's a type of respiratory panel, like some proprietary one that has a whole bunch of different viruses in it?
That's correct. It basically has probably 15 or so different viruses that it checks for. What's interesting is that it also has coronavirus in there in the panel, along with parainfluenza, metapneumovirus, influenza A and B. And what a lot of people know by now is that those coronaviruses are not the novel coronavirus. And so having that being negative, that shouldn't make you feel comfortable.
Right. I think our lab report specifically says at Cashtag Northeast, this is not the coronavirus you're looking for. Like, I think it's...
Right.
Yeah. A month, 3 weeks to 4 weeks ago, not everyone knew that. And they were getting lots of panicked calls. So I just wanted to, I guess, one comment and then a follow-up question. So you mentioned you're being a good internist and thinking through like the differential diagnosis for ARDS. And Cyrus had pointed out this great New England Journal review that we can link to in the show notes. It mentions that the most common things we should think of are pneumonia, aspiration of gastric contents, and sepsis. And then there's all sorts of other either direct lung injuries or indirect lung injuries
that can
lead to this. So that was the comment. And then the question is, you mentioned procalcitonin, and Paul, dare we go there? Paul, dare we go there?
I was going to dare if you didn't, just because I never know what to do with that. So what do you do with that? So how does that actually help guide your management? I am truly asking as someone who's just a procalcitonin agnostic.
So, in our limited experience during this pandemic, the procalcitonin isn't very helpful in helping differentiate viral infection versus bacterial. However, if I've had patients in the past with very, very high procalcitonin levels, and in that scenario, it would make me, let's say with the same presentation, it would make me think, could this be a bacterial infection that's going on that we're dealing with? And so in that way, it would help me. When it's like 2 or 3 or 4, you're absolutely right. It doesn't really help the clinical, situation.
Yeah. The Internet Book of Critical Care podcast, those guys talked about this recently too. They're doing some great stuff on COVID as a shout out to that one. And they mentioned the same thing, like a negative ProCal is helpful. You know, it's pointing towards that this is a viral thing. A super, super high one might make you think there's more of a bacterial infection. But then a lot of patients fall in that kind of middle, like 3 to 10 range is what they were the range that they were giving.
Yeah, so that's absolutely correct.
This is almost a complete aside, and we can even cut this out if it's not relevant. But as we're testing patients who are COVID suspect, there's a huge battery of labs that we're checking just to find some sort of signal in the noise. And what happens is that the COVID will come back negative, and then you have a D-dimer of 3,000, and you have this abnormal procalcitonin and a CRP that's slightly above normal. I'm like, I don't know what to do with any of this information now. Like, it's just so you're just stuck there with a D-dimer of a bazillion and someone who does not have coronavirus, at least so far as we know.
Or at least in that first test.
Right,
test,
right, it right. Be a false exactly. Negative. Yeah. As the test begins to fail us more, right?
Yeah.
I think we should just call it out specifically. I mean, it seems like it has better specificity, the nasopharyngeal swab, than it does sensitivity. And so people, you know, for this patient, as you mentioned, you're super concerned for COVID, even a negative test there, you're probably going to keep this person on enhanced droplet and treat it as if it is COVID.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, we've had many, many cases where they present very similar to this and they're negative, and we, you know, that first test and we're like, nope, we don't believe that. We test again and it's negative, and we still say, nope, let's test again. So I've gotten three tests before with a tracheal aspirate on top of that. And you know, that's how we're dealing with this right now.
Yeah. And for this particular patient who's looking kind of garbagey. So as just, I'm a simple country doc in the Northeast, and I see this patient, my algorithm would be to call an intensivist. And so I call the intensivist to see the patient, i.e. you. What are you thinking about as you're thinking about sort of airway management and where to go from here? What are the things that are important to you? And what do you have sort of a simple algorithmic approach that you go to for patients like this?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I look at the patient, and if they're talking to me and able to complete their sentences, I know that I have some time. It's when they start, you know, really breathing heavily and using accessory muscles, and they can't even complete a full sentence, that I start thinking, clinically, I should probably think about either non-invasive ventilation or getting them intubated. The accessory muscle thing is really the key. I think that's something that, for me, during this pandemic, taking care of these patients, that's my trigger to really think about securing the airway. As long as the patient's talking to me, there are many different options we have available in the hospital that can be utilized, and we can talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I think that would be helpful. Just maybe the things that I hear about high flow nasal cannula, and then some of the non-invasive options like a bi-level positive pressure ventilation, just maybe briefly talking about kind of when you use them, how you use them, and perhaps if you can comment at all on the concerns about aerosolization of the virus with the use of those modalities.
Yeah, so, you know, it's really interesting because none of us right now, even, you know, weeks into this pandemic, can really call ourselves experts in this. You know, it takes 10 years or so to really become an expert, the 10,000 hour rule, right? And so nobody really in this world has had that many hours taking care of COVID patients. Maybe, I don't know. But you know, so there's lots of, you know, there's lots of controversy with regards to what is aerosol generating and what is not. I recently had a conversation or email conversation really with some colleagues in South America who basically stated in their guidelines that they're not going to use non-rebreathers even because they think that is aerosol generating. And so it's something that is certainly evolving, and who knows what the right answer is. For right now, we escalate from, you know, simple nasal cannula. You have plenty of patients on nasal cannula in the ward. When you get to about 6 liters, that's when you need to make a move to something higher concentration. That's when you move to a non-rebreather. Generally, a simple face mask is fine, and a non-rebreather is technically a step up. But in a rapidly breathing patient, they're in training room air, you know, around the side of the masks. And so that reservoir is not really acting as an O2 reservoir, if you know what I mean. And so when somebody's breathing rapidly, a simple face mask is, a non-rebreather is just as good or just as bad as a simple face mask. So with regards to high flow nasal cannula, there are a variety of different high flow nasal cannula devices out there. And most of them go up to 40. Some of them go up to a little bit higher. In general, there's actually a technique that is important to apply in these patients. You can't just slap on high flow nasal cannula and walk away because it's something that is very foreign. And whenever, you know, early in my career, when high flow nasal cannula was new, I used to bring the residents and the fellow into the RT room and I had each of the residents and fellows put on the high flow nasal cannula, and I would turn up the flow to 40 liters per minute and just had them just, test out what that felt like. And it's, I would highly encourage you to try that sometime. It's actually, clears your sinuses. but regardless, there's actually a technique. You want to titrate up kind of like you do with, a non-invasive positive pressure ventilator. You start at like 10, 20 liters per minute. And the nice thing about the high flow is that you can independently adjust the flow and the FiO2. So there are two different knobs that you're turning, right? And so you're adjusting the flow and going up to 20 liters, let's say. And when you initially start someone, you can crank up the FiO2 to 100%. Just leave it there, right? And so you turn up the flow slowly and coach the patient through the nasal cannula breathing. So breathe in through your nose, breathe out through your mouth, and as you do that, purse your lips. So purse your lips. And what that does is it generates sort of this intrinsic PEEP that is helped by the flow. And there have been studies that have been done in terms of how much pressure high flow generates. And at 40 liters per minute, in the retropharyngeal space, there's actually, you can register pressures as high as 5. So it's like getting a PEEP of 5 at 40 liters per minute. And so there's a little bit of respiratory support that it's able to deliver, as well as the high concentration of oxygen. And so, the big concern right now is, is this an aerosol generating procedure? And so among our first patients that developed this syndrome needed an escalation of oxygen therapy. We asked, hey, let's put them on high flow. And everybody, nurses, RTs, looked at us like we were crazy. Like, oh my gosh, you're endangering our lives. And that's something that we had to work through. And, what we decided as a group is that, okay, high flow, we don't know if it's aerosol generating, but in order to minimize the potential for transmission to our healthcare workers, what we're going to do is, number one, we're going to put them in a negative pressure room if they go on it. And number two, we're going to put a mask over them. So a surgical mask. And so that's not something that we typically do, but anything that we can do to minimize transmission, aerosol generation and transmission to our healthcare providers, we're willing to do. And that's what we've done recently. Right now, the party line is, and this is not, based on any literature, the party line is, in the United States, CPAP. You want to try to avoid as much as possible. I feel like, we're watching these videos of YouTube videos of what's happening in Italy, and it seems like everybody's on BiPAP, these big hoods that you probably have seen. And you're like, well, what is going on there? They ran out of ventilators. And so at times of desperation, we may say right now, oh, let's hold off on BiPAP. Let's go straight to intubation. When we run out of ventilators, BiPAP is going to become an option.
So probably a lot of the issue with this is so much of this is anecdotal, and we haven't done enough data to know what's true and sort of what's noise. But you hear about this sort of, I've heard it described as apathetic hypoxia, where the patients are sort of hypoxic but feel okay. And then along with that anecdotal reports, there's this idea of proning patients, having them lay on their bellies, even in the absence of ventilation. So you just have them lay prone, and then people are reporting you see your oxygenation improve. Is this something that you're doing for patients like this who look kind of dicey but aren't quite ready for intubation just yet?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I told you early on that my trigger for deciding to intubate somebody is when they get tired. And so I can assess that by, physically just looking at them visually. And if they're using their accessory muscles, that they're starting to get tired. And then I keep on asking them, hey, how are you feeling? Do you feel tired? Some patients will tell me, I'm exhausted. Can you please intubate me? No kidding. That has happened. But if they're doing okay from a work of breathing standpoint, and it's just the hypoxia that you're dealing with, that's, you can manage that. You know, you can deliver, you know, as much oxygen as any ventilator could. And so, that's where the high flow nasal cannula is very, very helpful. You mentioned awake, proning. And so, you know, I've done a little bit of a literature search on this because we started doing this because, you know, we're sort of in desperate times at the moment, and we're trying to figure out, you know, strategies to avoid mechanical ventilation at all, you know, if at all possible. And so, there have been two papers that have been published. I think one had 15 patients, and the other had 20 patients. That's the level of data we're talking about, not randomized. but the thing is, oxygenation improved in those patients. And so if you want to buy yourself time for either the patient to heal or for whatever therapy you're instituting, right now we don't have any, that's the problem. But if you're just trying to buy time and you're trying to avoid intubation, and you're trying to see if the patient will just get better on their own, a trial of awake proning is fine. And I would encourage that. Just know that it's not based on high quality evidence. You're just buying time. You're not curing disease. And hopefully, you know, something in the body is starting to work and your immune system is trying to defend itself, and the patient's going to get better on their own. That's the you know, best case scenario. Another thing is that some patients don't tolerate awake proning. You know, we've asked patients to do this, and we say, hey, can you lay on your belly for a little while? And they're like, no, I can't do it. You know, back pain, or the bed's just uncomfortable, and others are glad to do it, and they're just on their bed. You know, it's adult belly time, adult tummy
right,
time. That
right.
is, and so they're fine with it. And so it really is. You should individualize that technique, and in those that can tolerate it, it looks like clearly it's buying time. And we have had patients in the ICU who were trying other therapies, and we're doing this just to try to avoid intubation. And in some patients it works, others it doesn't.
You partially answered my question there. So the awake patients, you can instruct them, just lay on your belly, because yeah. There was someone joking around on Twitter about repurposing the ortho team to help prone patients. And I didn't know if that was a joke or not, because I can imagine if someone is actually like lined up on a ventilator and then you're proning them, that's a much bigger thing than if it's just somebody that's like 40 or 50 years old and you're like, just lay on your belly for a while.
Right. It's much easier when the patients can prone themselves. I can tell you, proning somebody who's mechanically ventilated, paralyzed, and doing it with a bunch of lines coming out, you know, a bunch of drips, connected to the ventilator, it's not an easy task. And you mentioned the ortho team and the surgical team. You know, in the hospital, who has the most experience proning patients? It's them, because they do it every day for spine surgery. The first patient that we proned, our unit, our ICU, hadn't had somebody that needed proning on their own bed for a very long time. Typically what we do, we have this luxury of being able to order this magnificent bed that looks like a huge tank. It's called the rotoprone mattress.
Yeah.
And it just basically rotates you around and around and around if you want, you know, back and forth. We don't do that. We just use it to prone once. But since that's not available because they're all taken right now, we have to prone the patients in their own hospital bed. And that takes technique, that takes experience. And so for our first patient, we asked one of the surgical nurses to come up, OR nurses, who had a ton of experience doing it, and she helped out. And we were able to successfully accomplish that.
So I think we're going to take a brief detour here into mm-hmm. ARDS before we get back to kind of talking about some of the specifics of intubation. So when you go down to see this patient, the oxygen requirement's high, but they look comfortable right now. They're actually not using a lot of accessory muscles. Don't look like they're going to tire out just yet. And so you're thinking this, but you are thinking this is ARDS. So How do you actually make the diagnosis? What are the criteria as people working in just as hospitalists probably aren't used to thinking about this as much other than just send them to the ICU once you think someone has it?
Yeah. So I consider, I mean, the lung is an end organ like every other organ. And so when I see bilateral infiltrates on a chest x-ray, the first thing I think of is the lungs are injured, you know, because of either a pathogen or because of a perfusion problem or because of, you know, secondary to sepsis, or the patient's volume overloaded and they're in heart failure. So it's one of those two, right? And so really by definition, ARDS, acute respiratory distress syndrome, is non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema. That's by definition. And so technically, to make the diagnosis of ARDS, we use the Berlin criteria. And technically, they have to be on some degree of PEEP. And so we don't generally diagnose ARDS in a non-intubated patient. We just don't do that in practice. Although if they're on high flow or a little CPAP or BiPAP on a non-invasive ventilator, technically they meet the criteria, one of the criteria. The other criteria are bilateral infiltrates and ruling out a cardiogenic cause, and really that's just clinical judgment. Really, it's not that sophisticated. It used to be like a wedge less than X, you know, to make sure that they don't have cardiogenic shock. And then there are different degrees of ARDS. So once you diagnose ARDS, yes, no, then you categorize them by mild, moderate, and severe. And the way you categorize them is using the PF ratio. The PF ratio is the PaO2 divided by the FiO2. And, you know, normal people are walking around with PF ratios around 400, 500. Patients with a problem, you know, with ARDS, they're less than 300. And so that we consider that mild. Less than 200 is severe, moderate, and then less than 100 is severe. And so that's how we classify and stage ARDS. And there's a clear stepwise increase in mortality as the severity of ARDS increases from mild, moderate to severe. And so, you know, you don't necessarily make that diagnosis right off the bat. You have in the back of your mind the patient has some problem that's probably non-cardiogenic that's resulting in injury to the lungs that's causing them to have problems breathing and oxygenating. That's how I sort of frame the problem as I wheel them up to the ICU.
So let me try and do a recap, and then we'll kind of move on to the next part of the case. So we went down. So we're sending, like, we're going down to look at the patient, look at their, are they working hard to breathe? Are they tiring out? ABG, lactate, a BNP, the one that you check for heart failure, not BMP, basic metabolic, right. Procalcitonin, which is most helpful if it's really low or really high, and then a viral panel that's going to check a whole bunch of different viruses, and probably this patient, and we would do the specific COVID test as well.
Okay, so Kevin, you've got the patient now. You brought him up to your ICU, and as he's been transferring, you know, it's taking 5-10 minutes for him to get to the ICU. He's just kind of starting to look a little sicker than when you saw him in the emergency department. You know, you've got him on high flow now. You've got him kind of maxed out on the high flow nasal cannula, and the pulse oximeter is only reading 90% to 92%. You're starting to see some increased work of breathing, and you're kind of considering your options. You briefly thought about non-invasive positive pressure ventilation, but really the writing's on the wall. This guy needs to be intubated. So I think that, you know, we could spend an hour talking about the nuance of how you intubate this patient and who makes up your intubation team, et cetera, et cetera. I think that at this point, what I would say is, you know, you page for the team, the team's there, you got the patient intubated, and now the RT turns to you and asks you, you know, what settings do you want? And I think, you know, take it from there, you know, how do you start this patient on positive pressure ventilation?
So that's a good transition. And so what, you know, what I'd like to do is really strip down mechanical ventilation to the most clinically relevant items. and then really go from there. And we'll talk about initial settings. The way I like to think about it is in terms of volume or pressure. So you're either targeting a specific volume for every breath, or you're targeting a specific pressure. And the most common mode that's utilized is assist control. So you're either on a volume assist control or pressure assist control. I'll limit my discussion to that and leave SIMV and pressure support and volume support alone for now. And so for volume assist control, which is the most common mode, conventional mode of ventilation, there are a couple of variables that you want to sort of tell the RT. First, you want to tell them what rate. You know, in general, we say 12. But in a patient that's been breathing really hard, and let's say they have already, you know, they were breathing with a minute ventilation in the 20s, and you just put them at 12, that may not be enough. So in a, you know, depending on the situation, you may start at 18 or 20. It depends on the situation. Then you tell them a tidal volume. Again, if you're targeting a volume, you give them a specific tidal volume, and that tidal volume is anywhere between 6 to 8 cc's per kilogram ideal body weight. So you look at the patient, and if their average size, 80 kilo, you're talking about, around 400, if you're taking 6 cc's, 400, 420 cc's per kilo, per breath. And so you give them a tidal volume, you give them a rate, and then you give them a PEEP. And generally, most patients that we intubate will start at 5, but every patient needs to have the PEEP titrated, and I like to say that you should titrate the PEEP to the patient as much as possible. And then there's the FiO2. And generally, when you intubate somebody, the first initial setting, you're going to start at 100 and then titrate down from there. And so that's really what you start with. Those are the settings. And then you get a gas, and then you adjust ventilation by increasing the minute ventilation, the respiratory rate and tidal volume. Or if the patient is having an oxygenation problem, then you can titrate the PEEP, drive up the mean airway pressure. Since you're already on 100%, you don't have a lot of room there. You work on the PEEP in order to increase the mean airway pressure so that you improve oxygenation. So ventilation, to improve ventilation and CO2 removal, you're working on the respiratory rate and the tidal volume. In order to improve oxygenation, you're generally, you got the FiO2, and then you're generally left with the PEEP.
That's hugely helpful. I don't have many patients, I have to confess, that are anywhere near their ideal body weight. And I know there's calculators and stuff online. Do you have a back of the cocktail net calculation to just kind of guesstimate what someone's ideal
body weight? My back of the cocktail napkin calculation is I look at the RT and ask them, hey, can you figure out the ideal body weight? Because they'll get out their tape. Yeah, they'll get out their measuring tape and then punch it into their MedCalc and spit out a tidal volume. So
that is each time.
Yeah, and so you know, you may be able to figure that out on MedCalc, probably has it. And so it's really based on height and then gender.
Gotcha.
I for a second there, I thought there is a Curb Your Enthusiasm from season 10 where Larry finds one of those guess your weight guys at a carnival, and he like gives the guy $100 to guess the weight of all his friends and family. It's pretty good. Anyway, I digress. I've derailed the show. So now we know, one of my follow-up questions to this was we have the patient intubated. We're going to look at the respiratory rate and tidal volume to ventilate them, and the PEEP and FiO2 to oxygenate them. How often, when's a good time to check that first blood gas? And can I check just a venous gas, or they have to be ABGs?
So that's a good question. In the absence of an arterial line, or in the absence of access to the artery, so for example, you're waiting for an A-line, or you're waiting for somebody to get an arterial stick, you may have a central line. And so maybe they're having trouble getting that that stick. And so a VBG is just as good, in terms of trending and doing vent adjustments from. And so, you know, in general, I'll use that to just get a sense of where I am. So, for example, if the pH is 7.1 and the PCO2 is 70 or 80, then I know I need to do something. Whereas if some, you know, if you're looking at a VBG with a pH of 7.3, you know, anything above a 7.25 is like a survival condition. So you can probably chill out a little bit to 7.25, no matter what the PCO2 is. And so, you know, if you're looking at a 7.3 and PCO2 of 50, you know, you can sit back and let the, you know, patient just sort of settle out. They're probably getting sedation started in the form of propofol. You're probably hanging a little bit of fentanyl, and you're trying to get things situated. And in general, about an hour later, once the dust settles, you can probably, hopefully you'll have an A-line by then. And so what I didn't mention earlier is that, you know, if you have that VBG, obviously you can't titrate the PEEP. For that, you have the SAT. Hopefully you have a reliable saturation of the regular pulse ox. And so with a pulse ox and a VBG, you can pretty much get by. Optimally, you want an A-line in, and you want to be checking arterial blood gases.
Can I ask, before we move on to talking about some of the pressure stuff, or maybe this relates,
yeah.
I know that there's a peak pressure and a plateau pressure,
right?
And you want to keep those within a certain range. Does the PEEP affect those, or can I just go buck wild with the PEEP and put it up to like 20 or something? Like, what's a range of PEEP that I should feel comfortable with?
So first, you mentioned peak and plateau pressure. This is a good time to sort of discuss what that is. So peak pressure is really the pressure that is transduced at the end of the ET tube as air is rushing into the lung. And so the things that impact that pressure is basically general airway resistance. And so anything that that impacts the resistance will increase the peak. On top of that, if the patient's edematous or if they have, let's say, a pneumothorax, all those things will impact the peak pressure. The plateau pressure is really something that you have to measure and be deliberate about measuring. And so you have to talk to the RT and say, hey, can we get a plateau pressure? And generally, most RTs are checking it every 4 hours anyway. Right, so peak pressure, you're seeing it on the monitor. Every time a breath goes in, you'll register a peak pressure because it's just every time it's just registering what the pressure is as air is rushing into the lung. Plateau pressure is something that you have to measure by holding a button that says inspiratory pause. Right, so you press that button and have the patient breathe in. Right, the air is going into the lung, and you pause that breath, that inspiratory breath, such that all the pressure that is now rushed into the lung is dissipating all throughout the lung. And you're measuring that plateau pressure. What you're measuring is transalveolar pressure. So it's the best surrogate that we have for pressure that's being exerted at the level of the alveoli, right? So that's the plateau pressure. And so really what's interesting is that when both peak and plateau pressure are elevated, that takes you down this differential that's very different from when you have a peak pressure that's elevated and the plateau pressure is the same. So if there's a discrepancy, the delta widens. So if both the peak and plateau pressure are getting elevated, that means that it's not about the airway. It's about everything that's around the airway. What's squishing that alveoli that's causing that peak and plateau pressure together to go high? So you mentioned PEEP. So if you turned up your PEEP to 20, your peak and plateau pressure can't go lower than 20 because you're already, you know, there, right? And then now you have to account for interstitial edema, thoracic compliance problems. Maybe they have a big pannus and you've given them a lot of fluid. They have abdominal compartment syndrome. All those things register into the plateau pressure, and then together peak and plateau go up together. And so if you have both peak and plateau pressure elevated, then you know that something's compressing the alveoli. You know, an example is hemothorax, a pneumothorax, so on and so forth. When you have a discrepancy between the peak and plateau, so that delta widens, then you know that it's obstruction. Okay. And so obstruction can happen because what it means is that, you know, that peak pressure is registering some resistance in the airway somewhere between the ventilator and the alveoli, right? But the plateau pressure has remained the same. So that means once the air dissipates, the pressure that you're measuring, that's a surrogate to the pressure that the alveoli is feeling, is the same. And so that means when you have that discrepancy, that means there's an obstruction. So where is that obstruction? It could be in the tubing. It can be in the ET tube. So sometimes patients wake up a little bit and they start biting the ET tube. Nowadays we have bite blockers, so we prevent that. But you know, let's say we had 100 intubated patients, not everybody's going to have a bite block. So you know, that could be a potential problem. So what happens? You look at the patient, if they're biting on the tube, and that's why their peak pressure alarm is going off, then you sedate them a little bit more. And then the next thing you do, you suction them, because you know, if you have thick secretions, that's going to cause airway resistance and, you know, thereby increase the peak pressure. So you suction them and see what happens. And then the last thing is a small airway collapse or spasm. And so if you have somebody with small airway disease like asthma, that can cause a peak pressure to go get elevated while the plateau pressure remains stable. And so in that scenario, you give them an MDI. I would say NEB, but nebulizers are considered an aerosol generating procedure. And so right now we're using MDIs. And so there's a sequence of things that you can do based on the differential presentation when you look at the peak and plateau pressure.
And I wanted to shout out to another one of your colleagues. I believe it's Dr. Jessica Bunin.
Yep,
If I'm pronouncing it wrong, I apologize.
That's correct.
She has some wonderful YouTube videos that talk. I think they're each about 15-20 minutes, and they talk through a lot of the specific things. She does some on vent management as well. Those were really helpful in preparing for this.
Right.
And so with the peak with the resistance, the peak pressure, that was a really good differential diagnosis. And for the plateau pressure, some of the other things mentioned, other than like there can be either external compression or filling of the alveoli with like blood, pus, fluid, and in the case of ARDS, they could get high plateau pressures from filling with fluid and inflammatory cells.
That's correct. That's correct. Filling with either blood or exudate or whatever, anything that fills the alveoli, that'll register as a high plateau pressure.
And this seems like it would just be harder to treat. It doesn't seem like as easily as like just give bronchodilators, make sure they're not biting the tube.
Right.
So if someone has a high plateau pressure, is that a patient that you identify as like, this person's in trouble? Like what should Paul and I do if this comes up? I don't really know how to troubleshoot this one.
Right. So that's an evolving, we're talking about an evolving patient. And so one of the things that we should talk about is if you're deciding to put somebody on a volume targeted mode, so volume assist control in this setting, which is really the most prevalent mode, it's a mode of choice for most patients. Like you said, we have to measure peak and plateau. Peak and plateau gives you information about lung compliance. Okay, so let's say you intubate somebody and their plateau pressure is 30. You know that they have really stiff lungs, for example. And so over time, let's say you diurese the patient, and after 3 liters of diuresis, the next day the plateau pressure is 20. So went from 30 to 20, you know that the lungs got a little bit better and they're a little bit more compliant, right? And so on the flip side, if you intubate somebody, you want to go ahead and make sure that you measure that peak and plateau so that you can get an idea of where they are at baseline. And so if we think about the things that you want to monitor after you intubate a patient, it's PF ratio. And so you get, ABG serially. Something that I like to also incorporate into, in terms of deciding how well somebody's doing or how bad somebody's doing is the oxygenation index. I don't know if you've heard of that, but PF ratio is a little bit flawed in that it's not in, accounting for the degree of support that you're providing the patient to result in that PaO2. So for example, if you had a PF ratio of 300 on a PEEP of 5, you know, and then on the next patient, you have a PF ratio of 300 on a PEEP of 20, those are two different patients, right? The PEEP of 20 patient, although PF ratio is 300, is sicker because they have stiffer lungs, right? Because they needed that degree of PEEP to get to that PF ratio. And so PF ratio by itself is not a good way of really deciding how well somebody's doing from an oxygenation standpoint. It's oxygenation index that really is helpful because it indexes the PF ratio to the mean error pressure that you're delivering to get to that PaO2. So oxygenation index. And so the three things I monitor are the PF ratio, oxygenation index, and then some assessment of compliance. Now, again, in a volume targeted mode, it's peak and plateau. On the flip side, if you are on a pressure assist control mode or pressure targeted mode, you want to monitor volumes. Okay. So let's say you put somebody on a pressure assist control of 10 and PEEP of 5. And at that pressure of 5, their tidal volumes are, you know, 300, 400. And then you do some type of therapy over the next 24 hours, you diurese them, let's say. And then their tidal volumes at that given pressure is 500. That means their compliance got better. Okay. And the flip side can be true, where you have to, in order to generate a tidal volume, you keep having to increase that pressure. And so, that'll give you a lot of information as to which direction the patient is heading. Again, on a volume targeted mode, peak and plateau, PF ratio, and oxygenation index.
So when the patient, we have our patient on the vent, we made our ventilator settings, we have them on the vent. What are you paying attention to when you're looking at the patient and when you're looking at the ventilator? Anything that we should really pay mind to?
Right. So this is a very important question because it's happening all over the place where the patients are going on low tidal volume ventilation. We're adjusting the PEEP. So one thing that you got to look out for is patient ventilator dyssynchrony. Okay. And so, Stuart's not here. We can talk about Stuart, right? So let's say Stuart runs a mile.
Okay. To be fair, before you go on, we can talk about Stuart even if he is here. That's totally, totally acceptable.
He may or may not be paying attention if he was here.
Let's pretend Stuart can run a mile for the purposes of...
He listens to episodes of the Curbsiders, doesn't he?
I highly doubt that.
Okay, so let's say Stuart runs a mile, okay? And immediately after he crosses the finish line, he's huffing and puffing. We intubate him. And he requires, because he's really, really tired... for every breath, he requires a flow of 100 liters per minute, okay? We intubate him, and for every breath, he needs like 600 to 800 cc's per breath because he's just pooping, you know, he's really, really tired and he's breathing really hard. So we intubate Stuart, okay? And we cap the tidal volume at 400, okay? We fix the flow because, generally when we put somebody on volume assist control, we don't even look at the flows. That's automatically put in, and it's generally a fixed flow of 60 liters per minute. We make them breathe these very small tidal volumes, and we fix the flow. What do you think Stuart's going to do when you do that to him?
Become hypercapnic?
No, he's going to freak out. Right, because you're probably, you know, his sedation's hasn't caught up to him, so he's going to freak out. So what do we do when that happens? He's not getting enough flow, and his tidal volumes aren't big enough for what he needs, right? And so what do we do in practice when and these patients that are getting intubated? That's really the clinical scenario that you're seeing. They're running a marathon, and they're highly metabolic. They have this huge minute ventilation requirement. We're intubating them and we're fixing their flows and we're fixing their tidal volumes. Okay. And so these patients are going to be irritated because they're not getting the breaths they need. So what do we do in response as clinicians? We sedate them more. Okay. Instead of giving the patient what they need, we're driving up the sedation and making the patient tolerate what we're giving them. Okay. And so instead of doing that, think about flow as a variable, because in somebody that's huffing and puffing and you intubate them and give them these tiny, tiny tidal volumes, they may need a flow of 80 to 100, and you can adjust that. You can tell the RT to adjust that. In general, this happens a lot, right? So we'll put somebody on and the alarms will go off, and then we'll look at around, you know, in the patient's room, and we'll be at the bedside, and you know, let's just increase the patient. There's a lot of ventilator desynchrony, patient ventilator desynchrony. Let's increase the sedation. Instead, go to the bedside. What you can do is one of two things. You can increase the flow just arbitrarily, or you can switch them to pressure, a pressure targeted mode, pressure control, assist control ventilation. Instead of a fixed flow when you're delivering a volume targeted mode, pressure control, it's variable flow. So since you're targeting a pressure, every breath, whatever the patient needs, they'll get that flow, right? So if you switch them temporarily to a pressure control, assist control mode, then you'll be able to see how much flow they desire, the patient desires every with every breath. It may be 100, it may be 120. And so once, if you do that temporarily, you'll be able to see how much flow that they need for per breath. And then now you can match the ventilator settings to what the patient needs.
Is this flow, I know that the term is lung protective ventilation, and that means right. that's where we're choosing this low tidal volume instead sure. of like of 6 milliliters per kilogram. Sure. Does the flow go along with lung protective ventilation, or is there a risk if you put the flow really high, like twice the normal, that it's going to hurt the lungs or worsen the ARDS?
So this is a critical question. And so in a non-compliant lung, you know, in general, we want to try to non-compliant. What I mean by that is a true ARDS with filled alveoli, stiff interstitial, spaces, with edema or scar. You want to make sure that you limit volutrauma as well as barotrauma. So we limit the tidal volumes for volutrauma, and we also limit the pressures that are exerted at the level of the alveoli at 30. We try not to go higher than that. Okay. But what we're seeing in these patients, and this is where it gets kind of screwy, because we're trying to apply ARDS net settings to a lung that is relatively compliant and not having problems with alveolar filling just yet in the beginning. Okay, so when we put these patients, these COVID patients on, what we're observing, and this is what's been reported throughout, the collective experience, that's what's been reported, is that these patients, when you first intubate them, have really nice compliant lungs or almost normal compliance. And so in that situation, it may not be beneficial to stick with 6 cc's strictly. You may want to look at the patient. And, some would argue put them on pressure control right away, but if you're sticking with a volume targeted mode, in many places, that's what they want to do. You want to make sure that they're getting the flow correct for that patient that they're in front of. And so, whatever vent mode you initiate, whatever, whether it's volume or pressure, you want to look at the patient and make sure that on a volume mode, they're getting the right flows and their plateau pressure is reasonable. If you switch them to a pressure assist control mode, you want to make sure that the tidal volumes generated are sufficient and you're not going above a pressure of about 30. So in general, with these nice compliant lungs, you may only need 5 or 10, for example. And so strict ARDSnet. ARDSnet over time, you're absolutely correct. You want to protect the lung as much as possible from the harm that ventilators can induce. But we have to rethink our initial settings when you're dealing with non-ARDS lung. Is it really helpful to limit the tidal volume at truly 6 cc's? And a lot of people are driving up their PEEP right off the bat, arbitrarily, without trying to individualize it to the patient, and that could be problematic, and that can cause hemodynamic problems. And so the bottom line is, you set your initial settings, You look at the patient. If they're not tolerating it, don't just sedate them. Try to figure out what's going on. Get your RTs involved. Get your intensivist and say, hey, this patient's not tolerating the vent. And there's a lot of patient ventilator dyssynchrony. If you say those words to the intensivist, they'll be pretty impressed. But when you're faced with that situation, the knee-jerk response is sedate the patient. But maybe not. Maybe you shouldn't do that. Maybe you should look at the patient and see if we can find a ventilator mode that's more comfortable so that we don't have to sedate them and paralyze them.
What you're saying makes a lot of sense. I think you could probably still make a really compelling argument for sedating Stuart specifically there.
Yeah. And paralyzing him, hopefully with enough sedation.
Well, that's a perfect segue. I know we wanted to talk a little bit about some additional troubleshooting in certain circumstances. And I know we're also starting to kind of discuss the differences between what I'll call garden variety ARDS and then the COVID-19 specific patient. Before we kind of flesh that stuff out and then let you get to bed, Kevin, for our audience, and maybe for my own understanding, it sounds like, in terms of compliance, we're really trying to keep those plateau pressures under 30. That 30 is kind of the number that we're really trying to keep an eye out for. And it sounds like in your more kind of garden variety ARDS patient who does have higher plateau pressures, there may actually be some harm done if you were to just kind of increase the flows as you were talking about. And I guess that gets back to eyeballing the patient. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I think we have to think about it a little bit from a different angle. I think plateau pressures being high and trying to limit the plateau pressures is a true statement. We want to do that, but what we're dealing with is if we get a patient that has a plateau pressure of 30, then what you should register in your mind is, oh my gosh, I'm dealing with a really stiff lung and these lungs are really sick. That's what should register instead of focusing on, hey, let's try to keep this plateau pressure under 30. I think that's true. You need to do that. Absolutely. As you're titrating up the PEEP, you want to try to minimize and not go, you know, for example, you can't turn up the PEEP to 24 and then leave the tidal volume at 500. Let's say you were doing 6 cc's or 8 cc's per kilo. That would be problematic. That's when you have both barotrauma and volutrauma. So, you know, you want to always, whether it's the initial setting or as the lung disease evolves, you want to apply the principles of lung protection, which is what you're mentioning. Try to limit the tidal volumes and try to limit the pressure as much as possible. But when that plateau pressure is 30, that should register in the back of your mind, hey, I got a problem here. It's more diagnostic than anything else as far as I'm concerned. You know, and so when we were talking about earlier, how do we monitor these patients over time, that's why that plateau pressure is so important. To sort of monitor on a day-to-day basis throughout your shift at night and in the morning.
So I think probably the last question we have time for before take-home points is, I guess, a bit of a two-parter. Can you tell us, for a patient with traditional ARDS, what are the evidence-based therapies that we would cycle through if we were treating it? And then maybe the second part of that would be, how are we seeing that being different in the patient with COVID-19?
Yeah, those are good questions. I think a lot of the principles are remain the same. So I generally advocate for the P's, and I have it down in terms of what is backed by randomized controlled trial and level one evidence to a certain degree. We could limit it to the 5 P's. The first P is lung protection. So the principles of lung protection should be consistent throughout as much as possible. And so that's one. PEEP is the second P. So optimizing PEEP. For every patient, the optimal PEEP may be different. And so, the best way to determine what that optimal PEEP is through an esophageal mammometer, but you don't have that luxury. So generally, clinically, you just do it at the bedside. You start with a PEEP of 5 and then see what happens. You go up to a PEEP of 10 and see what happens. If the oxygenation improves, then you can keep going up. there comes a point where the PEEP is too high. And you'll know by, you know, seeing that if you go up from 15 to 20, for example, that the patient all of a sudden needs pressors. You know, that's a problem. And so that's when you want to turn it down. And so optimizing PEEP is the second P. And then prune, prune is for trying to dry them out as much as possible. And in general, in these patients, early on, you want to make sure that they're intravascularly volume replete. As the disease evolves, sometimes they'll go into shock for other reasons, and you'll need to give them some fluid. And then after the patient has stabilized and maybe you've weaned them off pressors, the strategy is try to get them as dry as possible. So that's a scenario where they've passed that acute phase and now you're dealing with stiff lungs, the plateau of 30, they're 5-6 liters positive. And so this is where daily weights and watching them day to day is very important. And you're going to say, okay, I'm going to try to shoot for their dry weight over the next 2 or 3 days, which means that you got to have an accurate weight when they get admitted, right? And so so that's when you start that Lasix or BMX drip. You may want to chase that with a little albumin. There is some evidence for that. It's clear that dry lungs are happy lungs. And there's a nice New England Journal study, randomized control trial called the FACT trial that showed that. And then, so that's the third P. The fourth P is what people have been talking about, prone. And you can talk about that for another hour. But this is something in ventilated patients. There's mortality benefit. A couple of trials have demonstrated this. And then the fifth P is a little bit controversial because the first trial that came out again in the New England Journal demonstrated benefit, but the second, another trial demonstrated no benefit. And so we're not really sure whether this improves outcome long term, but paralyze. So that's the fifth P. And so in general, we'll use a neuromuscular blockade called Nimbex, cis atricurium. And it's something that doesn't require intact kidney or liver to get rid of. And so it's metabolized very rapidly. But still, we're not sure long term if that's the right thing to do. I think, you know, we're quick to paralyze patients when they're not syncing with the ventilator. As I said earlier, I think it's probably a better approach to try to match the patient need with the ventilator setting, carefully titrate the knobs in the ventilator so that they tolerate the ventilator better rather than, sedating them and paralyzing them so that, they tolerate it. They tolerate whatever we give them. Who knows about the paralysis? Still, that's something that you have in your back pocket. Those are the five P's. And there's a six P, which is put on ECMO. But we don't have to talk about that right now.
Yeah, ECMO. I don't think Paul or I are going to be deciding when anybody needs ECMO. Hopefully
no,
there
I'll
will
the
be
cannulating. It'll be fine.
Hopefully someone else will be there. And I think this is a really great summary. I think if we're at the point where we're kind of throwing Hail Mary passes on these patients, we will be hopefully having an intensivist that we can speak to about this, where the patient's really going to be in trouble. So this was fantastic. We definitely have to let you go. And I would ask you, what are a couple take-home points that you really want people to remember? And I know we barely scratched the surface. There's so much in this topic, and we're going to point people to other resources to supplement this and maybe make some more ourselves in the future here.
Well, I think practically speaking, the reason we're having this talk right now is because, internists and hospitalists are being asked to come and help augment and help in the ICU. And so really the most practical advice I can probably offer is that I would meet with the ICU attendings that are there, that group, ask them if they have an algorithm. If not, ask them to create one for you for specifically for this scenario. And I think that's going to be more helpful than anything else we talked about.
Right. And I think University of Washington, I think places like Brigham, I'm sure if they DM Stewart on Twitter, he would send them information.
Right.
There's everybody is really open sourcing everything at this point. Yeah. So
it's good.
You should be able to get your hands on an algorithm. And Kevin, before we let you go for real, is there anything that you would like to plug before we let you go?
Yes. So relevant to what we face with the current pandemic, our group has created a website that has a lot of resources I think that could be helpful to everyone. The website is COVID-19toolbox.com. It was created by one of our pulmonary sleep fellows, Brian Foster. In it, you'll find multiple tabs that includes the DoD COVID practice management guide. It's started at 50 pages and now it's over 100 pages of, it's really a comprehensive manual that if you know the DoD, DoD is going to really, you know, be really detailed in instructions. And so I think that's going to be a nice guide. And then in that website also is a tab that takes you to the YouTube videos, the instructional videos that you talked about, Matt, featuring yes. Dr. Jessica Bunin. And others. It's a compilation of videos. Now it's including nursing instructional videos, how to set up A-lines. There's also instructions about how to set up ventilators in case you run out of RTs. You may want to do that. And so it's a this website is something that I think could be helpful to a lot of folks.
Kevin, thank you so much for all your time tonight. This was, I feel much less anxiety than I was feeling before this. I feel somewhat ready to go in there and at least just ask the nurses and respiratory therapists what to do, the people that normally work in the ICU. But thank you for this.
Well, thanks, guys. This has been a great honor and a pleasure. Great talking to you guys.
Likewise.
Thank you so much. Appreciate your time.
This has been another episode of the Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole. Nope. Didn't like that one either. Get your show notes at thecurbsiders.com/podcast and sign up for our mailing list at thecurbsiders.com/knowledge food to get our weekly show notes in your inbox.
We're committed to providing you with high value practice changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or contact us at thecurbsiders@gmail.com. Special thanks to Cyrus the Younger, Cyrus Askin for producing this episode, as well as Michael Rose and Kathleen Hiltz for helping to write and produce the show, to Elena Gibson for doing some of our figures and images for this, and to our social media team, Hannah R. Abrams on Twitter, Beth Garbs Garbatelli on Instagram, and Chris the Chew Man Chew on Facebook. Until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Watto.
And I've been Dr. Cyrus Askin.
And I would be remiss in not thanking Stuart for composing our excellent theme music, and also thanking Claire Morgan of Nautilus for editing our audio as per always. And also as per always, I remain Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Thank you and goodbye.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.